Senator Pogemiller.
I move that further proceedings under the roll call be dispensed with and a sergeant-at-arms be instructed to bring in the absent members.
On the motion, all those in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Today's chaplain is Reverend Paul Rogers from Minneapolis, the official house chaplain. It's good to be official.
Right? Yes. Yeah. We'll pray officially. Let us pray. As we approach another day of bills and budgets and committees, we raise up to you, gracious God, those who surround the sisters and brothers here in the Senate. We pray for all who miss the presence of the senators, the children and spouses and partners waiting for the weekend when the household can be whole again. We pray for colleagues and co-workers at jobs all around the state working hard to cover the absence of these men and women here this morning, looking forward to the end of the session. We pray for the staff members of the Senate, all in the office of the Secretary and Sergeant at Arms, the pages, all who support the Senate committees and offices and caucuses, working often under pressure, faithfully providing documents, research, security, assistance to the public, yet often invisible to the public. We acknowledge, O God, that all of these people make a contribution to the work of the Senate and to the welfare of the state. We thank you for them, and we ask you to bless them all. Amen.
Very nice. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you.
Secretary will take the roll.
Anderson, Bach, Berglund, Betzel, Bonoff, Carlson, Chaudhry, Clark, Cohen, Day, Dibble, Dill, Dahl, Erickson, Ropes, Fischbach, Foley, Fredrickson, Gerlach, Gimsey, Han, Higgins, Ingebrigtsen, Johnson, Jungbauer, Koch, Coring, Kubli, Langseth, Larson, Latz, Limmer, Lori, Lynch, Marty, Metzen, Michelle, Moi, Murphy, Neville, Olsen, Olson G, Olson M, Ortman, Pappas, Parisot, Pogemiller, Pretner, Solon, Rest, Roebling, Rosen, Rummel, Salzman, Saxhog, Scheid, Senjum, Sharon, Sieben, Skoy, Skogan, Sparks, Stumpf, Tomasoni, Torres Ray, Vandeveer, Vickerman, Wergen, and Wieger. Quorum is present.
Quorum is present. First order of business is messages from the House.
Mr. President, I have the honor to announce the passage by the House of the following Senate file as amended by the House, in which amendments the concurrence of the Senate is respectfully requested. Senate file 1949. A bill for an act relating to the Minnesota Sesquicentennial Commission changing certain duties and procedures. Senate file number 1949 is herewith returned to the Senate. Signed, Alvin A. Mathewitz, Chief Clerk of the House of Representatives.
Do I announce for the amendment, sir? The amendments can be found in the House Journal, April 24th, pages 439 and 4341. 4341. Senator Rest, do you have a motion to make?
Mr. President, I move that the Senate concur in the amendments by the House to Senate file number 1949 and the bill be placed on its repassage as amended.
Senator Rest, tell the body that the differences, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senate File 1949 dealt with the Sesquicentennial Commission. The House added the amendment to their version that we had adopted that had been offered by Senator Dibble with regard to activities being energy efficient as practicable. And in the introduced version of the bill, there was a section on powers of the commission, and the House left that section in, and it is in the State Department's budget bill over here, those are the only changes, so I request concurrence.
Discussion on the bill as amended by the House. Senator Rest renews her motion, or moves that the Senate concur in the amendments by the House that Senate File 1949 and a bill be placed on repassage as amended. On the motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Further discussion on the bill, the Secretary will give Senate File 1949 its third reading.
Senate File 1949, a bill for an act relating to the Minnesota Sesquicentennial Commission changing certain duties, powers, and procedures.
Secretary will take the roll. All senators having voted, desire to vote. Secretary will close the roll. Be at 60 ayes, 0 nays. The bill is passed and its title agreed to. Next order of business is first reading of House Bill. Oh, excuse me, before that, we have one more message to be read.
Mr. President, I have the honor to announce the passage by the House of the following House file, herewith transmitted House File number 854, signed Albany Mathewitz, Chief Clerk of the House of Representatives.
Okay, now we go to first reading of House Bills. There's one on today's printed agenda. Without objection, the bill, first reading of House Bills. Senator, next order of business is reports of committees. Senator Pogermiller.
Mr. President, I move that the committee reports printed in today's agenda be adopted with the exception of the report pertaining to appointments.
On the motion, all in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Let's see, the next order of business is second reading of Senate bills. They are printed on today's agenda. Without objection, second reading of Senate bills. Next order of business.
Mr. President, apparently I need to move to table the appointments then.
I thought he said with the exception of the appointment, then you move to table the appointment. Yeah, that's correct.
Then, Mr. President, I would move to table those relating to appointments.
Appointments, okay. I thought it's. Okay, on the motion. All in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. I think we did second reading of Senate bills. Next order of business, second reading of House bills. There's one printed on today's agenda. Without objection, second reading of House bills. We're under motions and resolutions. There are three authors' motions printed on today's agenda. Without objection, we'll take them as one motion. All in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Next order of business will be the Senate calendar.
Mr. President, staying on motions, I would move that the Senate, that we take up
take
the
up
Senate
the,
calendar.
On the motion to take up the Senate calendar by Senator Pogermiller. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Again, I remind you, I guess every day we do the calendar, that there will be votes. The first bill to be considered on the calendar will be number one, Senate File 1144. Secretary will give the bill its Third reading.
Senate File 1144, a bill for an act relating to crimes providing testimonial confidentiality for certain sexual assault counselors, etc.
Secretary will take the roll. Senator Olson, Jen. All senators having voted, desire to vote. Secretary will close the roll. Read 61 ayes, 0 nays. The bill is passed. Its title agreed to. The second bill on the calendar be Senate File 1857. Secretary will give Senate File 1857 its third reading.
Senate File 1857, a bill for an act relating to energy, regulating service disconnections by public utilities during winter.
Secretary will take the roll. All senators having voted, desire to vote. We're not. Yeah, let's. Secretary will close the roll. Be it 63 ayes, 0 nays. The bill is passed. Its title agreed to. Third bill on the calendar will be Senate File 1557. Secretary will give the bill its third reading.
Senate File 1557, a bill for an act relating to state government, deleting a record retention provision.
Secretary will take the roll. We could do these. Having voted, desire to vote. Secretary will close the roll. Be it 63 ayes, 0 nays. The bill is passed. Its title agreed to. The fourth bill on the calendar be Senate File number 475. Secretary will give Senate File 475 its third reading.
Senate File 475, a bill for an act relating to health, removing the expiration date for radiation therapy facility construction limitations and providing two-year moratorium on construction in certain counties.
Secretary will take the roll. All senators having voted, desire to vote. Secretary will close the roll. Be in 56 ayes and 7 nays. The bill is passed. And its title agreed to. Without objection, we'll take up Senate bill introductions and first reading of Senate bills. They are printed on today's agenda. Without objection, first reading of Senate bills. Senator Pogermiller.
Mr. President, I move the Senate do now resolve itself into a committee of the whole for the purposes of taking up the general orders calendar.
On the motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. The committee shall be in order.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogermiller.
Mr. Chairman, members, there's a general orders list Wednesday, April 25th. Starts with number, it's one, two, it's about five bills. And we'll start with Senator Solon, number 36.
Senator Solon, numbers 36, Senate File 140. Senator.
Thank you, Mr.
Solon.
Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File 140 be recommended to pass.
Discussion on the bill, Senator Solon.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the intent of Senate File 140 is to provide access to private restroom facilities and public places of business for individuals with fecal or urinary incontinence due to a medical condition. The language is modeled after a bill passed in Illinois 2 years ago after a teenager with Crohn's disease was refused bathroom access in an Old Navy store and suffered an embarrassing accident as a result. The bill was unanimously passed. Since passage, there have been no negative consequences or problems with the Restroom Access Act for retailers. In Minnesota, approximately 24,000 individuals suffer from Crohn's and colitis. This bill will also help people suffering from roughly 40 other medical conditions, such as Parkinson's and various cancers that cause issues of incontinence. Subdivision 3 requires a retail establishment that has a toilet facility available for its employees to allow a customer to use its facility during normal business hours if all of the following conditions are met. First, the customer has an eligible medical condition or uses an ostomy device. Second, there are at least 3 employees working at the time of the request. Third, the retail establishment does not normally make a restroom available to the public. Fourth, the location of the restroom does not create an obvious health or safety risk to the customer or a security risk to the establishment. And fifth, the public restroom is not immediately accessible to the customer. Nothing in the Restroom Access Act is a mandate. Retail establishments are not required to reconfigure their stores to be in compliance. If the restroom is in an area that is not safely accessible or would be a security risk, to make it accessible if there is an exemption. Subdivision 4 deals with liability language and is a compromise between the Retail Association and the Trial Lawyers Association. It implies a simple negligence standard. The language is a balance that protects both the patrons and the retailers. The liability language applies to almost all types of injury claims. The person bringing the claim must establish the burden of proof. This section does not require a retail establishment to make any physical changes to an employee restroom. Subdivision 5 provides that a violator of this section is guilty of a petty misdemeanor with a fine not in excess of $50. Ensuring restroom access to people with Crohn's and colitis is a common sense solution that will be good for business because these people will have the freedom to patron the retail establishments. The Restroom Access Act is an extension of customer service. It is not going to be for every customer. It is a few customers with special needs who otherwise might not be shopping in these establishments. Individuals with these medical issues resort to staying at home where restroom access is not an issue. The Restroom Access Act will contribute to sales revenues and to the state through sales tax revenues. And I urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Any further discussion on Senate File 140? Senator Worgen.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. Chair, I have the A3 amendment.
Secretary will report the Worgen A3 amendment.
Senator Worgen moves to amend Senate File 140 as follows, page 1, line 11. This amendment is designated A-3.
Senator Worgen, on your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Crohn's disease and colitis are very serious issues, and these are folks that can't wait to use a restroom. They have an uncontrollable condition, and it is not always convenient at convenient times that they need to use a restroom. And so my intention with this amendment is not by any means to destroy the bill, but to still allow those same people access to the bathrooms that Senator Solon is talking about. But what I would like to prevent with my amendment is someone coming into a store and saying to the clerk, I need to use the bathroom, and the young 19, 18, 17-year-old clerk says, sorry, my boss said the bathroom's not public. And so then we get into this situation in the front of the store where the employee is saying, this is not a public bathroom, I can't let you use it, my boss said so. And the poor person with the disease can't get to the bathroom in time because of the argument. So what my amendment does, the first part says that the person with this condition is to carry a card or something in writing that says, I have a condition and I need to use your bathroom, so that there doesn't have to be this public argument. And actually, members, Senator Solon passed out a sheet of paper from the Colitis and Crohn's Foundation, and on their sheet they say that they already provide I can't wait cards, which would do exactly what my amendment is asking. So thankfully, some of the organizations already recognize that they don't want the public embarrassment for their members. And so I think the card would go a long way towards avoiding confrontational or embarrassing situations for folks that already have a disease that they need to deal with. The second part of the amendment on line 1.8 of the amendment removes the word negligent from the the standard at which there can be prosecution for not providing a bathroom, and instead it inserts willful or reckless. That simply is a little bit higher standard. It basically says that the store owner cannot willfully or recklessly, in other words, they can't just plain stand in the way of safe use of a bathroom or impede that use or put something on the stairs that leads to willful or reckless endangerment of the person using the bathroom. And then the third part says that the first violation will be a warning to the city or county attorney, and the warning will be a letter back to the retailer. And I do that because in small-town America, they're not necessarily going to know about this law at all. And most store owners are very pleasant about letting you use their bathroom. But we do have situations where bathrooms are very inconvenient, and so they hesitate. And I'll give you the example from Main Street in the city where I live. You walk into the front of a store, and it's a substantial store, and it's a very nice store, but it's old. That's just the reality. It's old, and everybody loves the store, but it's old. And you have to walk from the front of the store to the back of the store, go down a flight of steps, and then go through basically their storage area back to what would be the front of the store on the main level, and up two steps and into the bathroom. And so I want the standard to be something they have to meet. So, Mr. President, I would really like this amendment to go on. And members, I would request a roll call vote, and I would sincerely ask for your support, not out of a way to denigrate the bill, but to make the best possible situation for the person with the disease and for the store owner who is affected as well. Thank you, members.
Three hands for roll call. Senator Pretner Solon, we're on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regards to this amendment, the first section would work for people with Crohn's disease or colitis, because they do have a card that is available to them. It is not going to work as easily for people who are pregnant, who have cancer, who have Parkinson's. There is not a formal card, and their associations would have to construct something that would be available to hand out. And I imagine that is something that could be done. But I would like to remind members that there have to be at least three employees in the establishment at the time that the patient or the client, the patron, requests to use the bathroom facilities. And so there is the likelihood that somebody in authority is going to be there who would be able to direct them as to whether or not they could use the facilities and would be familiar with the law. I do object to 1.8, which deletes negligent and inserts willful or reckless, because this is not much different from what was worked out by the retail association and the Trial Lawyers Association. And I would remind you that this was compromised language, and one that was agreed upon by both sides. As far as the I have no difficulty with line 1.9 through 1.11. Can you hear me? Okay. This Actually, I have no difficulty with lines 1.9 through 1.13. If it's possible, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if we could divide the amendment.
Yes, you can.
And
you could tell us which.
I'd like to divide it after 1.8, so that everything above would be the first section of the amendment, and 1.9 through 1.13 would be the second section of the amendment. And, Mr. Chair, I would urge members to vote against the first 1.1 through 1.8 and for 1.9 through 1.13.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay, the division is,
Mr. Chairman?
After 1.8, and it includes 1.9 to 1.13. Senator Hamm?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not getting this amendment on the system. Is it up?
Apparently, it's up on the computer. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Correct me if I'm wrong. Are we dividing the amendment between lines 1.8 and 1.9?
That is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And it's your choice which part of the amendment you want to vote on first.
Mr. Chair, I believe I would take part two first, lines 1.9 through 1.13.
Okay, is it clear to the members what we're doing? We're going to vote on the second part of the amendment at this time. Further questions?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe I need a roll call on that. And members, I would urge you to vote in favor of this, because I know that even though the retailers have to have three employees, they just simply don't always know when those employees change. They don't always know what the law is. When it's something like this, we know what they are because we're here. But prior to getting here, I would defy anyone to tell me what was in statute that every store clerk would know regarding a store. And so, members, I would urge a yes vote on the lines 1.9 through 1.13, the first part of the amendment.
Senator Limmer on the...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you please explain to the body what a green vote and a red vote would mean? Does a green vote mean you're voting in favor of the language in front of us?
Okay, let me try to back up here a little bit. We're dividing after 1.8 and 1.9. We're voting now on 1.9 to 1.13, but Senator Wergen has withdrawn the roll call request on that portion. It appears as though Senator Wergen and Senator Prettner-Solon agree on this part for sure. So I think it's just going to be... A voice vote. Is that correct? Okay, all those in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. That part of the amendment is adopted. Now we're looking at 1.1 to 1.8. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I believe that this part of the amendment is equally as important. And I know that, and I mentioned that the folks with Crohn's disease and colitis already carry a card that says, I can't wait, and explains it. That's wonderful. And Senator Solon expressed concern for other folks, such as those females that are pregnant, those that are suffering with cancer, and other conditions such as that. However, if you look closely at the amendment, it simply says that they need a statement from their physician. And so if you have cancer, or typically if you're pregnant, or any of those other things, it should be fairly simple to get a statement from your physician that says X and so needs immediate access to a bathroom and signed by doctor such and such. I don't think that's too much to ask. And folks, whether you believe it or not, my motive for this is to save the embarrassment of the patient. I don't want the argument in the front of the store. I don't want someone's 8-month pregnant daughter or someone who's suffering the debilitating and potentially terminal disease of cancer to have to get in an argument with a store clerk in the front of the store. And a simple card or letter signed by the doctor could take care of that so quickly. That's my main impetus here, is to help that person avoid the embarrassment. And the second part, the negligent change to willful or reckless, yes, that is a little higher standard. But negligent could mean almost anything, and the store owner is responsible. And these bathrooms were not put in for public use. They were put in the mechanic shop for the quote-unquote, what we all call grease monkey, though we love them because they keep our cars running. There are places like that where it's the mechanic's bathroom. It's not necessarily real clean. And there might be something on the floor. Or they might store something in an old big bathroom. There might be a storage shelf. We're talking about stores that are small, hometown, basically. And they're older. We're not talking about the new McDonald's. We're not talking about Kohl's. We're talking about Main Street, Jack and Jim's, whatever. And you have to go downstairs and around the corner. And those merchants, those buildings are 100 years old, and it's not convenient. And they shouldn't be held responsible for an accident that they had no way in some cases of being prevented, because negligent is an awfully low standard. I want access to the bathroom for these folks, but I don't want the stores to have to be afraid every time they say yes to someone. Thank you.
Senator Wergen, did you wish a roll call on this one?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do. Thank you.
Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair.
Members, I think, you know, this is a good bill. We heard, it seems strange that we'd have to do it, but we heard pretty compelling testimony in committee for it. But I do have to say, I think Senator Wergen's amendment is a real plus to this, and that we should support it because, number one, I mean, if you think of what you have to do to get a handicapped parking space, all she's asking is a card with something from your doctor, which most people could get, and I do believe that would save embarrassment. But number two, we do have to remember that these are bathrooms that are not intended for public use, that we're telling the store owners that they do have to allow people to just go into if they, you know, say that they're eligible to do it. And I think we should be very clear on the extent of liability that they'd have. So I believe we should support the Wergen Amendment.
Senator Prettner-Solon and Senator Boniff.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I have heard Senator Wergen's arguments, and actually I can support the first half of this amendment, but again, I would like to divide the amendment at 1.7 and take 1.8 separately, if I may request that. And I would continue to speak against 1.8, as I must remind committee members that this was agreed upon by both the Retail Association and the Trial Lawyers Association. They felt that it protected everybody's interests. And so I would urge you to support the language that is in the bill and vote against 1.8.
Again, Senator Wergen, maybe you will want to withdraw your request for a roll call from 1.1 to 1.7, since the author of the amendment and the author of the bill agree. Was that correct?
Mr. President, it certainly seems as though I can do that. And Senator Prettner-Solon, I very much appreciate your understanding of the fact that I am trying to get away from the embarrassment for the patient, and I appreciate your acceptance of the first part of this amendment. Thank you.
Okay, all the members know we're voting on lines 1-1 to 1-7, which both the author of the amendment and the author of the bill agree on. All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Now we're on the amendment is down to 1.8, page 2, line 11, delete negligent and insert willful or reckless. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. President. It'll be tough to divide this any further.
I think that does it.
Senator Prettner-Solon, I didn't think my one amendment would turn into three, but let's make the third part work, too. Maybe I can convince you that this is necessary, too. Mr. Chair, I would request a roll call on this part because we do have in every small town, and in some cases in large cities, in the older parts of the city, we have situations where retailers aren't going to know this, aren't going to be prepared, and they're not going to willfully or recklessly place something in the way of someone that has a disease. And so, members, I would ask for a roll call, and I would ask for your support of the last part of my three-part amendment.
Three hands for roll call. Discussion, Senator Moi.
Thank you, Mr. President. I just want to remind the members that line 1.8 is the standard of proof necessary, and the negligence standard was brought into the Judiciary Committee as was negotiated upon the stakeholders. And so I would respectfully ask the body to respect the work that was done as well as the compromise that was struck among the stakeholders by opposing this part of the amendment. Thank you.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe would the original author of the bill be willing to answer a question with respect to this standard of negligence?
She will answer your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to understand this compromise that has been talked about a couple of times here. We do have something that was distributed by Senator Wergen from the NFIB that talks about the original language did have this willful and reckless rather than negligent. And I guess what I'm trying to understand is why is it better to apply a negligence standard to a non-public part of an establishment? In other words, hold an establishment liable for if someone were to slip or fall or something that really is not an act of intentional harm on the part of a retailer, with trying to make accessible to someone a part of their building that is not public. Why would they be held to that same standard that would be applied to people in the public part of the building? I'm not sure if I understand what the rationale for this compromise, if it is one, why that should be applied. Could that be explained?
Senator Prettner-Solon, would you yield to Senator Betzel? Senator Betzel, would you? Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hahn, actually, I'm not sure that I can answer that. I can tell you that it was worked out between the Retail Association, Trial Lawyers Association. Both sides signed off on this. They were happy with it. That's good enough for me.
Senator Betzel, did you?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, I think that the negligence standard would be the appropriate one here. We're talking about businesses that have restroom facilities but currently don't expect their customers to go back there. But they apparently do expect their own employees to go use their own restroom facilities. Why should the restrooms be in such horrible shape for their own customers, or for their own employees, excuse me? They should maintain them in such a way that their own employees don't go back there and get injured right now. And so if you have an occasional customer that goes back and is using the employee restroom, I think that they should maintain the same standards as they do for their own employees. Basically, if it's a willful or reckless standard, you'd almost have to have a situation where the floor is falling apart, you can fall through to the basement, there's danger back there and so forth. I don't think I'd tolerate that for the employees of the place, let alone for the customers. So I think negligence standard is the appropriate one here, and so I would oppose this part of the amendment.
Mr. Brent?
Further discussion, Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Betzel. I appreciate that explanation. I don't disagree that retail establishments ought to have facilities for their employees that are up to par, and I believe that they do. I guess my thinking about this is that if you're allowing, say, 10 or 8 employees to use a facility on occasion, That's one thing, but if you're potentially opening up a facility to be used by hundreds of people, you have increased your risk simply by the magnitude of the access that you have granted, and there could be nothing at all wrong with the facility. Someone could just slip. Someone could accidentally trip on a stair, or in the circumstance that Senator Wergen was talking about, they may be going through a warehouse area or some other area that's not commonly used by the public. They may be unfamiliar with some of the things that are there. They might have an accident. Nothing that would be out of the ordinary, nothing that would be inherently dangerous, something that employees, because they work there, might have been trained or been familiarized with, but the member of the general public might not be. And it would seem to me that you're, because of the frequency potentially of the people in those areas that wouldn't otherwise be frequented by the public, that you're increasing your risk. And so why, if we're going to mandate that increase of risk, why would we want to hold the retailers to the higher level of potential harm for doing that? And I understand Senator Pretner Solon has talked about this as an agreement. I don't know if NFIB was a part of the stakeholders. They clearly are not in agreement. But is there something beyond, is there anything to my understanding of this that needs to be corrected?
Senator Betzeld would...
Well, first of all, Senator Hanna, I agree. We're not bound by anybody's agreement. We have to independently make our own decisions here. But I think that this is the correct way to do it, because when I heard the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee, as I recall, this is not going to affect a lot of people. This is a fairly small number of people we're talking about who would just be using restroom facilities that right now they may not have access to. But say somebody right now gets injured in a restroom of a business. If it's an employee going into that, into a place of employment, goes in there and gets injured because of some negligence, I think that the employee could sue because of the negligence. I think that if a customer goes into a public facility today, a business that has a facility that's open, say a fast food place, and gets injured today because a restaurant is open to the public and they didn't clean the floors or it's slippery or some reason they fell down, they could sue and it would be a negligent standard. So I think that the only place that we would have this higher standard would be right here. And so I can't see what the difference would be. You know, why should restaurants in a business have a negligent standard for everybody else except for these individuals that absolutely have to use one, and that's going to be a different standard. I think we ought to have a consistent standard, and it seems to me the negligence one is for everybody else today. Why not for employees and customers? Why not just make it consistent here?
Okay, are we ready to vote on the amendment, Senator Neville?
Mr. President, I must have been dozing when it came through Judiciary Committee, or wasn't there that day. I do have a question on this liability issue. It strikes me, I'm not clear what the standard will be in a non-public area versus a public area. Negligence basically means that there's a breach of a duty. So you first have to ask yourself, what is the duty that exists? If you're out in the public area, the duty is pretty well defined by case law. It would probably apply to any slip and fall. If you're in a public area of a restaurant and somebody spills something and a customer slips on it, you have breached that duty and there's negligence. I'm not clear what the duty is in a non-public area, but it has to be something different than what's owed to an employee. Employees are covered by workers' comp. If they slipped and fell, or if they tripped down the steps going to the bathroom, or if they got scalded because the water was too hot in the restroom, or whatever the case might be, it's a workers' comp injury, and fault isn't even an issue in workers' comp. If the accident happens and somebody gets hurt, the employee is covered. Can anybody who's a proponent of this bill tell me what is the different standard or the different duty that exists if you're in a non-public area versus a public area? Maybe that's what we have to figure out first, because it's the breach of the duty that constitutes the negligence. So I'm looking for somebody to define for me what is the duty or the standard owed to somebody who comes into a non-public area. And if there was an agreement from the trial lawyers, they should have told some of you what that duty is.
Senator Olson, did you wish to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Neville and Senator Hand, I think first I'd like to address something Senator Hand said that's a common misperception that many people have. And that was when he said, when Senator Hand said that simply because someone slips and falls, that that would constitute negligence and the person would be able to sue for that. That's certainly not the case under Minnesota law. A person would have to prove negligence, which would mean that there was something inherently wrong with the facility that posed some type of danger before the person could sue. That's the negligence standard that's in the bill as it stands. To follow up and address Senator Neville's point, this bill does not require the employer to make any changes in order to comply with the request that that the person would make to use the facility. And so I believe that case law would recognize that part of this bill in saying that the standard would be just like any other case law would develop this just like they do in any other circumstance, and that's that the standard would be for a non-public restroom what is considered to be the duty of the employer, and it would be to maintain a non-public restroom in a reasonably safe way, just like any other factual circumstance under the law. But what we wouldn't allow under this law, for example, would be someone to be directed back to a bathroom where the owner knew a light was burned out on a stairway or something like that. That would constitute, under normal common law, negligence, and we certainly wouldn't want someone not to be warned of something like that.
Okay, Senator Olson, Senator Hand, and I think we're getting close to a vote.
Well, Mr. President, as I read this, I'm still confused. We've been focusing on the word negligent, but in order for the retail establishment to be liable, it appears by the way this is worded that all three of these occurrences would have to be in place before they would be liable, that they would not negligent, that it occurs in an area of the retail establishment that is not public, and that it results in an injury or death to an individual. So do they have to meet all three tests? There's got to be an injury, it's got to be in a non-public place, and it's got to be negligent in order for that to apply. That is correct. It's puzzling to me in something that is intended to improve customer service, provide for a need that is not now being met, and this law is making that required. I guess what puzzles me is are the trial lawyers short of work? I mean, are they looking for a new customer base? Or what in the world is going on here that one would have to try to make this easier for there to be a lawsuit, when I would think this is a group of people, and frankly, having, you know, as you get older, you may find yourself wishing, you know, appreciating this more than others would, but and not have to be entrusted to your wits to be able to persuade somebody that you have a need rather than what might be the alternative for them to have to deal with. Why we have to make such a big deal of a liability issue rather than one that actually is focused on protecting the people who are now obligated, not just of courtesy, but are obligated to make this available, and I think for the most part will understand and approve that there is some guidance in how to do that. But why are we making such a big deal of this, and why are the trial lawyers so concerned about it?
Senator Moi.
Mr. Chair and members, Senator Olson just made my point for me, which is that, you know, I don't know about the rest of you, but having been recently pregnant when you're 9 months, when you got to go, you got to go. And for people, when they got to go, they got to go. They don't have time to sit and negotiate with people in those stores. And I think that's why the retailers either have the facility, and when someone, and what we've just done with the amendment is we're requiring these people to have a card with them to say, I got to go, here's my card. You either have the facility and you allow them to use it, or you say, I'm sorry, even with your card, we don't have a facility and you can't use it. So when people got to go, they got to go. And I think we've had a long enough discussion. Let's go and take our vote.
Well, I agree with you there. Further discussion on the amendment? The clerk will take a roll, and the green vote supports Senator Wergen's amendment, which is lines 1.8. Secretary will take the roll. All senators having voted, desire to vote. Secretary will close the roll. There being 28 ayes and 34 nays, the amendment is not adopted. That's obviously 1.8, line 1.8. Further discussion on Senate File 140. Seeing none, the question occurs on the motion by Senator Pretner Solon that Senate 140 be recommended to pass. Three hands for roll call. Secretary will take the roll. Secretary will take the roll on the bill. All senators having voted, desire to vote. Secretary will close the roll. There'll be 51 ayes, 52 ayes, 10 nays. The motion prevails that Senate File 140 be recommended to pass. The second bill, number 27, on general orders, Senate File 1259. 2059, Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2059 be recommended to pass.
Senator Erickson Ropes on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. During a national search for a new executive director for the Minnesota Veterans Home Board, it became apparent that the requirement for this candidate to be a veteran was restricting the number of applicants that were applying for the job. So some language changes were brought forward, and we would recommend that changes include making the veteran, the applicant for the executive director, the requirement that they must be a veteran be changed to may be a veteran. And further, we're clarifying that the chair of the committee that deals with veterans affairs, or the chair's designee, also shall serve as an ex officio non-voting member of the board. And it also clarifies that the chair of the board must be a veteran. These language changes will greatly assist the Minneapolis Veterans Home Board as they look for the best qualified candidate for their executive director's position. Now stand for questions.
Discussion on Senate File 1259. Seeing none, the question occurs on the motion by Senator Erickson Ropes that Senate File 2059 be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Next bill on the Senate calendar will be Senate File 1178, Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when this committee do arise, that Senate File 1178 be recommended to pass.
Senator Berglund, discussion on the bill.
Mr. Chairman and members, this bill is a result of recommendations from the legislative auditor. They did an audit of services provided by the counties and found a lot of unevenness of services and a lot of different levels of service being provided across the state. They also made recommendations that we should look into the possible takeover of certain functions from the counties and be doing them more on a statewide basis. So this bill is a bill that will create a working group in the Department of Human Services made up of members of the counties, legislators, and the department to look at this issue further. The working group would expire, and they would be making recommendations back to the legislature. I'd be ready for any questions.
Any further discussion on Senate File 1178? Seeing none, the question occurs with the motion by Senator Berglund that Senate File 1178 be recommended to pass. All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Senator Pappas, you have two bills today on the Senate calendar. You can... Excuse me, general orders calendar. You can do one or two or whichever one you'd like to take up first.
Stem cell. Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. I didn't know we were going to skip over Senator Cohen's bill. I move that when this committee do arise, that Senate File 1070 be recommended to pass.
On the motion. Excuse me. Before that, discussion on the bill.
Yeah, that would have been quick. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the Omnibus Liquor Bill, and I'll just go through and explain the different sections. Section 1 and Section 7 is a Senator Anderson provision eliminating the restrictions on issuing a liquor license within 1/2 mile of the state fairgrounds or the St. Paul campus of the University of Minnesota. Section 2 is my provision that would allow intoxicating strong beer to be sold at the state fair, and they have to include a Minnesota brewed beer. Section 3 is Senator Bach bill to allow brew pubs and small brewers to sell 750 milliliter bottles at off sale. This is like the size of a wine bottle. Before, they were able to do growlers, so this is a little bigger. Section 4 is a Tomasoni provision to provide that nothing in the farm winery law prevents a farm winery from obtaining a separate on-sale license and operating a business establishment that uses that license within the physical facilities of the winery. Section 5 and 7 is a Senator Metzen bill to authorize the Commissioner of Public Safety to issue intoxicating liquor licenses to the Board of Regents of the U of M for events within the boundaries of the university campus. And I think they're looking at another 5 or 6 buildings, the sports stadiums and some others that, like the Wiseman Art Gallery and a few others. Section 6 is the Pappas bill to increase the fee for off-sale intoxicating liquor license issued by cities. And we also add a new tier fee for regional centers. But we also require that the vendors have training. Section 8 is a Sparks bill to allow a nonprofit organization conducting a silent auction to conduct live on-premises auctions of intoxicating liquors, provided the funds are dedicated to the charitable purposes of the organizations and they're limited to no more than six per year. Section 9 is a Senator Moore bill to authorize the City of St. Paul to issue an on-sale intoxicating liquor license to a restaurant located at 374-378 Mariah Avenue North. And I do have a technical amendment, the A5 amendment, which pertains to that section of the bill, Section 9. I'd like to offer the A5 amendment.
Secretary will report the Pappas, Senator Pappas, A5 amendment.
Senator Pappas moves to amend Senate File 1070 as follows on page 6. This is the A-5 amendment.
Senator Pappas on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. President. As I said, this is purely technical, changing some references.
On the amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Further discussion?
Then, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for questions, comments, or amendments.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of questions for the author. One, on Section 5, just want to clarify, the language would permit the University of Minnesota to sell alcoholic beverages at Northrop Auditorium, and I'm assuming the stadium, the football stadium. Is this any restriction? Is this beer only, or is this any kind of alcoholic beverage? And I guess I'm a little curious about why we're doing this. I mean, it doesn't seem as we've had this in the past. What's the necessity for the change?
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the A6 amendment.
Well, we're discussing, maybe you could briefly talk about the University of Minnesota issue, I guess, huh?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. I apologize, Senator Hahn. It is... It's Mr. Chairman's bill. I think it's necessary because right now they have to go to the City of Minneapolis and get authorizations to, or they have to hire a caterer that has a license. So this would streamline the process so that the Board of Regents could act more like the city acts in approving these licenses.
And Senator Hahn.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And just to clarify, so are we saying that currently the auditorium and the stadiums that the university operates do sell beer, wine, other forms of alcoholic beverages, but that to get permission they have to do it through a caterer or through some permission from the city, and this is just changing how that permission is done, or are we granting them a license to do something that hasn't been done in the past? That's what I'm unclear about.
Same thing, other buildings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your... just one other question, going to Section 9, I believe, the provision allowing St. Paul to, or allowing a business in St. Paul to petition. Why is that necessary to be done? Why wouldn't that be the province of St. Paul? I'm not clear on what we're doing here and why this has to be a state issue.
Senator Moi.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, restaurant or the little coffee shop is within 1,500 feet of Metro State University, and we don't permit alcohol licenses, so they're asking for an exemption or a waiver from that requirement.
Senator Hahn. Senator Anderson, did you have an amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize, I wasn't misunderstood before. I have the A6 amendment.
We adopt it, yeah. The Secretary will report the A6 Senator Anderson amendment.
Senator Anderson moves to amend Senate File 1070 as follows, page 6, line 10. This is the A-6 amendment.
Senator Anderson on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This simply adds to the section that permits the sale of wine or beer or intoxicating liquor at a silent auction, and we just add a raffle. And I'm aware of organizations, charitable organizations that have also sold wine baskets for raffles as well. So I just want to make sure that those are also included.
Senator Pappas on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and that's fine with me.
Discussion on the amendment. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Pogamiller commented to me that this was, he couldn't believe that we had the omnibus liquor bill up here and he didn't have any provision in it. So I was going to suggest to him that maybe Certix would like a license to sell more groceries or something in his district. But he asked me to say that, actually. You know, I guess I just haven't been as effective as I have thought I should be or want to be. I think part of my job as chair of the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee is to make sure that common sense applies, that we have a balance between consumers and industry, if you will. And I clearly have not been successful in getting that committee in the last few years to change some laws that I think sorely need changing. For the past, 3 years, several independent sources, including our own legislative auditor, have taken a fresh look at how we regulate the liquor industry in Minnesota. And they've reached three conclusions. We pay more in Minnesota for liquor than residents of many other states, especially our neighbors in Wisconsin. Our restrictions on retail liquor licenses are more stringent than the laws in most other states, and I think you were getting a flavor of how we regulate liquor in Minnesota with some of these laws you just can't believe are out there, but they are. And really, part of what the studies have shown, too, is that the beneficiaries, the primary beneficiaries of our, I would call, archaic system of regulating liquor are the wholesalers and the retailers. We guarantee their profit at the expense of consumers. So legislation trying to reform that, and particularly allowing wine to be sold in grocery stores, to be sold with dinner items, has stalled out. Some people think I'm not as enthusiastic as I once was. I know it's not the most important issue. It's not on that list of most important things we do around here. But it probably is right up near the top of common sense and doing something that constituents would like us to do. It's something like 70% of the people think they ought to be able to buy wine at the grocery store. You can do that in 33 other states. Iowa, Wisconsin, Florida, California, all kinds of places, but not in Minnesota. We've protected people from some bad thing happening. And by the way, liquor stores, liquor retail establishments coexist in those places. It's not as if they're driven out of business. Actually, competition works. It actually works. And it mostly works to benefit consumers. So this year we've done some reforms, certainly in the insurance industry, the automotive industry, the healthcare industry, especially the energy industry or utility industry. Just about every major industry in Minnesota has been subject to some kind of reform. And the liquor industry continues to operate under laws that are some 70 years old. So most of us have heard from a lot of constituents who would like to be able to buy wine at the grocery store. And by the way, the average purchase in a grocery store around the country is like 1.3 bottles. That's not going to put any liquor retailer out of business. People just know they're going to have pasta next week and maybe they'd like a bottle of red wine to go with it. You know, chances are right now they're just not even buying that wine. I've been saying we could raise revenue in Minnesota by allowing this without having to raise a tax because we would sell more wine. and that would be a good thing. So most Minnesotans support this. The liquor industry continues to lobby against it. But we're the ones who are making the choice to just further restrict or keep these restrictions on people's lives, even though they certainly have the sense to be able to handle buying a bottle of 1.3 bottles of wine at the grocery store. The internet has broken down some barriers restricting wine sales, but we're going to keep the fence up in Minnesota. Do you know that you can order your food from Simon Delivers and they'll deliver wine? They're not a liquor retailer, they're a grocer. Oops. So I'm not asking you to vote on this today. I didn't ask the committee to hear the bill. But I just want to point out to you that your constituents would like this. We spend a lot of time in the legislature doing things to people, regulating their lives. And I vote for those things. I vote to put seatbelts on people and for .08 and all other kinds of things, life jackets on children in boats, you name it. We're right there to tell people what they can't do. But we just don't trust their judgment to be able to buy 1.3 bottles of wine in the grocery store. Members, I just suggest that the public's ahead of us and that we probably should make some choices to act on behalf of our constituents rather than the few powerful and profitable institutions that that continue to benefit because of our archaic laws. And then at the end of the day, I guess the burden is really on me. At some point here, I'm going to have to do something else to try to convince you that we really do need to reform our liquor laws. And we need to do that perhaps in a more comprehensive way than just allowing wine in the grocery stores. But that's one place to start, and I would just... And then, you know, I would be remiss here right now if I didn't thank Senator Pappas for carrying the omnibus liquor bill. She's not a member of the Commerce Committee anymore, and we continue to have, of course, liquor regulation in that committee. But she's done it before and understands it really well and is very good-natured about and very receptive to carrying the bill this year, and I just want to thank her for doing that and thank members for indulging me.
Senator Corrine.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members. I just want to talk just quickly about my experience in owning a liquor store, which I don't own anymore, but I respectfully disagree with Senator Scheid, my good friend. I want to tell you about my liquor store. The liquor store that I had was a small operation that I bought. It was a mom-and-pop operation that grossed about in between $265,000 and $300,000, which was the gross. And the people that I bought it from, they had it for 23 years, and the husband and wife, they ran it. And as you know, they can't sell potato chips. They can't sell other things. All they can sell is they're restricted. They can only sell liquor. And so what you would be doing if you would say, okay, we're going to let grocery stores sell wine now, you're actually taking money away from this mom-and-pop operation, the way I look at it. And so I disagree with that. Now the people that I have sold it to, it's a husband and wife, and they're running it. And so what you're actually doing is you're hurting them because they're trying to compete with the big operations that maybe sell have a gross of $2 million a year and a 24-pack of beer that the small operation that I had, the other big stores are selling it cheaper than they can buy it. And so they're having a hard time competing. And so I just think that, you know, I don't think selling wine in grocery stores. You know, I don't see the problem in when they can just stop at the liquor store and pick up their liquor there and pick up their wine there. All you're doing is hurting. I think mom and pop operations, and there still are mom and pop operations, and so I just, and I think the margin, at least the liquor store that I had, once I paid out labor, paid the insurance, the margin of profit was very, very small. But maybe I was a poor businessman, but I don't know. But I would just say, I just respectfully disagree with you on that. And I know in my liquor store, I think it would have been a lot more profitable if I could sell potato chips and snacks and everything, so that then it was a one-stop shop to come and get your snacks and stuff. So,
okay, we're talking a lot this morning about what's not in the bill,
Mr. Chairman,
and what's in the bill. But that's all right. We can do that for a while. Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, just briefly, I just want to point out to Senator Coring that allowing retailers, liquor retailers, to sell some grocery items has been on the table and has been part of every discussion we've had. And I want to tell you that in about 1960, my dad owned he owned a service station for well over 40-some years, and he was put out of the oil change business by the big box discount stores where people could go and buy cases of oil cheaper than he could buy at wholesale. I understand exactly the premise. The point is, I would making the case on behalf of consumers, and also the fact that people will. I think more people will buy wine, and more people will end up going to liquor stores to buy better wine. Senator Coring.
So we're going to have any further discussion on the bill. Seeing none, the question occurs. On the motion by Senator Pappas that Senate File 1070 be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Okay, the next bill, I believe the final bill this morning will be number 34 on general orders. Senate File 100, Senator Cohn.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when this committee do arise, that Senate File 100 be recommended to pass.
Discussion, Senator Cohn, on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, members, this is the bill that authorizes the University of Minnesota to be involved in stem cell research. And obviously, every member on the floor of the Senate today has some sense of the issue and some familiarity with the issue. It's become possibly the most significant medical research issue in this nation and arguably in the world. And members are well aware of what the ability to use stem cell research might mean. I'm struck by the fact, and I think one of the things over the last several years that I've worked on this, last couple of years, I think one of the things that I find unfortunate is that we've tended to look at this issue so often from a partisan perspective and also, to be fair, from an ideological perspective. I'm struck that on April 11th, there was similar legislation up before the United States Senate. And the legislation that passed on a bipartisan basis. There were, I believe, 63 or 64 votes from almost all the Democrats and a significant number of Republican U.S. senators, including people who would be considered fairly conservative senators. Let me just, in beginning the discussion on this issue, quote what Senator Orrin Hatch from Utah said. I think members are aware that Senator Hatch was the previous chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, was a person responsible for shepherding the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts, Associate Justice Samuel Alito. So this is not somebody who could be considered a liberal Republican. What Senator Hatch says, what he said in Senate debate on April 11th, when I think about embryonic stem cell research, I imagine diabetics without insulin pumps. I imagine patients with Parkinson's disease who sprint rather than shuffle. I conceive of patients with spinal cord disease or injuries who stand up and walk again. Senator Hatch, in his comments, certainly was able to give a very succinct description of what this opportunity affords people throughout the world. If you talk to the researchers who are involved with the issue, they will tell you that absent the ability to use the full gamut of stem cells that are available, the research simply doesn't work. One of the things you've heard in opposition to this legislation is that this is research that really we're not quite sure where it's going to go. We're not sure that this is going to work. We have no proof. We have no cures as such. There have been some significant advances in the last couple of years. Some of the experiments with embryonic stem cells with mice have actually been successful. But the reality of medical research is that you don't begin the research today and expect the cure tomorrow. If you look at the great medical advances in the last number of years, the development of penicillin by Sir Alexander Fleming as an example, if you look at the gradual utilization of bypass surgery, what started with opportunities at the University of Minnesota as one of the world centers in the 1950s with pioneering that type of operative technique. You found that whether it be medical techniques, medical research, medical experimentation is something that happens over a period of years. The opportunity to use stem cell research and to try to succeed in utilizing it has grown by leaps and bounds over merely the last 2 or 3 years. What has been very striking, and the reason I offer this legislation, is that the University of Minnesota was arguably the world pioneer in this type of research. Now, with some of the parameters placed on the research, and to be blunt, some of the advances made by a number of other states around the country, Minnesota has become not secondary. It still is a very significant research opportunity in this field. But Minnesota has not been leading the pack as it once was. California has probably been the state that has stepped into that void. Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania. There are other states around the country where those opportunities had not existed, but they have eclipsed Minnesota. And that's why I offer this legislation. And what the legislation does is to allow the University of Minnesota to proceed as they have been and to establish a policy for stem cell research to make sure as to what you are doing the research for. That's contained in Subdivision 1 of Section 3. To allow for an informed consent if you are utilizing the embryos from a particular patient, and to make sure that you don't allow for the sale of fetal tissue. So there are the prohibitions and protections within the bill to make sure the research is done in an appropriate way, and it then allows the University of Minnesota to more fully proceed as ought to be the case. That's why I'm offering this legislation. Probably the part of the legislation, I shouldn't say the part that I don't like, but I think what has not worked out in terms of this is I would like to do what other states have done and provide some of the state dollars directly. California, members might recall, had an initiative on their ballot a couple of years ago where they provided $3 billion for such research. Wisconsin has provided significant research dollars. There have been other states that have done the same. That's why Minnesota is now behind that national curve. In Senator Lanxess' bonding bill, I had a chance on the floor of the Senate to discuss the provision that Senator Lanxess and I have worked on, the biomedical facilities for the University of Minnesota. We are attempting to make sure that Minnesota reclaims its position as the preeminent medical research state in the country, arguably the preeminent medical research place in the world. I reminded members on the floor when we had Senator Lanxess' bill that a place like Medtronic originated from the University of Minnesota. To allow the university to continue what they're doing with stem cell research, to provide these kinds of protections and controls, we get the opportunity to further this establishment, the reestablishment of Minnesota as the place for medical research, the cutting-edge research university in the country, hopefully the world, for medical research. That's why I offer this bill and ask for your support.
Further discussion, Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I have a couple of questions. Maybe the author of the bill can respond to some of these. But we heard this bill in the in Senator Marty's committee, and there were questions asked then. And to be honest, I was surprised, frankly, to learn that the University of Minnesota is conducting stem cell research other than that which has been approved by the federal law that allowed for the research to be done on, I guess, the 70 lines, and I'm not a scientist, I can't tell you exactly what that means, but there was a debate some years ago that at the federal level that said that there would be some permission to allow research to be conducted on a certain number of lines of stem cell, embryonic stem cells, and after that it would not be permitted. And I frankly was unaware that the university was, through private funding, doing research beyond this. And I think that raises some questions in my mind, particularly given the existence of Minnesota Statute 145 that seems to me to make it pretty clear that it is a criminal offense to do research on an embryo that results in the destruction of that embryo. And I know in the committee we had some research folks from the University of Minnesota. We asked them how they understood this law, whether the university had issued any opinions, and apparently they have not. They told us that they understood that the university's legal department said this was all right, but apparently there's been no official, documentation of the university's position on Statute 145 and how their current practice and now the desire to expand this to include the public funding of this kind of research, I think, is remarkable. And I think that this body ought to be thinking of asking the university to answer some further questions about what they're doing and how they're doing it, and why the public ought to support a university that is engaging in something that many find to be morally repugnant. And I understand, Senator Cohen, the argument, and we heard it from the researchers, that there is a desire to keep the University of Minnesota on the cutting edge of research. I think we all believe that it's a fine research institution. We want it to be the preeminent research institution. But not everything should be sacrificed on the altar of research. One could clearly conduct experimentation on human beings that would serve a research purpose, that we could learn valuable things. And there have been in human history societies that have done this and arguably have learned some things of value about the tolerance of human beings for pain or discomfort or other kinds of things that may be medically useful. But we recognize that there's some things we just don't do. And I think the question here is whether or not an embryo qualifies as one of those entities, or some of us would think are human beings, and whether there are some things that we ought to stop short of doing in the name of research. And so I'm troubled by this bill. I'm troubled by the rationale for it. I'm troubled by the fact that apparently the university has been engaging in research that most of us, or I assume I was not aware that they were doing. And I would ask members that we not pass this bill, that we try to hold the university to a higher standard, that we engage in some discussion about why we have a law that forbids the experimentation on embryos, and at the same time we're going to permit, we are permitting, but now we're going to fund the University of Minnesota to do exactly that. I think that to me is troubling, and maybe the author of the bill would like to respond to some of those questions.
Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, I want to respond carefully because I don't think you suggested this, but just so there's no inference drawn, it's not as if the university has made this work a secret. Members of Senator Pappas's division toured parts of the university at the start of the session. I think Senator Pappas, if I recall, most of the members of your division were part of that tour. And one of the places the tour went was to the lab where they're doing some of this research. And we met with Dr. Furpo, who's one of the principal researchers there. She talked about her work. She talked about how she had originally worked at the University of California at San Francisco, came to Minnesota. I've got in my packet a very glossy colored brochure from the university, which has been distributed around the Capitol, if not this year, I know last year, that talks about stem cell research. There have been numerous articles in the newspapers relative to that. So I want to make sure members don't, and Senator Hahn, I don't think you suggested this, but I want to make sure members understand that the university has made no secret of the work it's doing, the attempt that it's making to be, as I've suggested, on the cutting edge of medical research. If those questions are there for the university, it's not as if there have not been plenty of opportunities to ask those questions, whether it be when I have presented this bill in the various committees over the past year, this year and last year, whether it be in Senator Pappas's finance division. Obviously, there's been full participation in that division on the part of members, both majority and minority. So the university has not made a secret of it. You do make reference to the legislation, and I know that in Senator Marty's committee you raised some of the same concerns. And I can only suggest that the legislation, which goes back to, as I understand it, 1973, is legislation that doesn't really deal with this issue, because it talks about, you know, if there is a heartbeat, it specifies certain kinds of living types of, I'm not sure what the word would be, but examples of what a living human body might do. And in no way do, as Dr. Furpo pointed out in the committee, in no way do the embryonic stem cells or other stem cells exhibit any of those characteristics as specified by statute. And I do recognize, and Senator Hahn, I think, obviously from having gotten to know you a little bit over the last several years, that you're a very serious legislator, somebody who takes his positions from a perspective of integrity. And I don't want to diminish what you suggest. There are times in the context of legislative efforts where we don't end up being able to satisfy everyone on every side of an issue. Unfortunately, as you look at the national debate that has taken place relative to stem cell research, I would have to put this issue in that category. But I still think it's quite important that we allow the University of Minnesota, to be blunt, to not be a backwater research university. One of the things that Minnesota has taken pride in over the last number of years has been the combination of the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic. It used to be that that combination was unparalleled in this country. Unfortunately, as I've suggested, that has been diminished over the years. It's been diminished because of our failure to properly fund those kinds of efforts. In fact, this year, I might digress a little bit, but Senator Lynch has had her effort, which continues from legislation that I originally sponsored to provide for the continuation of the Mayo University of Minnesota partnership relative to biomedical research. We have the legislation in Senator Langseth's bill, and this legislation is part of that same package. In the process, you deal with medical research that arguably raises some concerns. I think I've tried to answer that. I would also suggest that if you look at medical research of 60, 70 years ago, if you look at medical research, and I don't presume to be a, my background's American history, but certainly not medical history, but as I've read some of what were the discussions of medical research going back to the 19th century, where concerns were raised about techniques that became accepted as the century went on, about how you could do some of these kinds of things with a human body. This is on a continuum, but I think if you talk to the people involved with the research, and it might be unfair to talk, you know, when I talk to the people who might not profit in a financial sense, but profit in a medical sense from this research, you know, the people with spinal cord injuries, the people with early onset Parkinson's, the people with severe diabetic conditions. This is the type of research that 10 years from now, when it's come to fruition, hopefully, will arguably be the most promising for so many of these chronic and debilitating and quite often life-threatening conditions. And that's why I've offered the legislation. But I do recognize that there is a disagreement.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of points. First of all, in the committee, the University of Minnesota did issue a legal determination that there was no violation of any current state statutes. And when I look at this proposal before the body today, this is really a proposal that's about hope and opportunity. It's about making real commitment to move this state and the university forward. And the fact is that with or without this legislation, with or without our support, this type of research will proceed in the private sector. And I would suggest that
As such, it's more unregulated, without public access to the knowledge and the process, the oversight. And our public research institutions like the University of Minnesota and the policymakers and the public want to be assured that there's an effective, thoughtful oversight to this research. You know, I think about the families that that view this as their only hope. Those families that are affected by Alzheimer's, diabetes. This gives them some sense of hope. The University of Minnesota believes that they are on the very cusp of making some strong advances in the next few years, 5 years, 10 years, in these areas. Sometimes opponents of this suggest that we don't really know what's out there. We haven't really seen those results. But what we have seen, and we did have opportunity to view this when we went over to the university, they have used stem cells to cure mice with type 1 diabetes. They have restored brain cells in mice paralyzed by stroke or spinal trauma. There's been reversal of the damage done to the heart muscle as a result of heart attack and other genetic diseases. And so, members, I ask you to think about those families that we have the opportunity to provide hope and opportunity to, and I urge your support of this bill.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I want to thank the author of the bill for his kind comments earlier. I certainly return those sentiments. I think Senator Cohen is a man of integrity, and I know that this bill is being presented for good purposes and with good intentions. And certainly, I want to make it clear that I don't believe that the University of Minnesota is secretly trying to conduct research and trying to keep that hidden from the public. But it's one thing to do something, and it's one thing to really publicize it. We all know, everybody in the state knows about the University of Minnesota and their athletic programs and a number of other things that they do. When you talk about stem cell research, because there are so many different kinds, there is the umbilical stem cell research, there is adult stem cell research, there is, I guess, placental stem cell research, there's embryonic stem cell research, there is the federal funding that's permitted, and so there are various factors of this that if you talk about, well, we're doing stem cell research, many people could interpret that to be one of a number of things. My point was simply that I don't believe, and I certainly wasn't aware, that the University of Minnesota is engaging in embryonic stem cell research beyond what has been permitted by federal law. That was news to me, and I would wager that it would be news to most people in the state of Minnesota. And I don't know that the University of Minnesota has taken an official position on this activity with respect to the law that we have passed. Now, Senator Lynch just mentioned that she said the university had an opinion. We asked for that opinion in the committee, in the health committee, that was not provided. And the response that we got was that there wasn't really an official position or an official opinion, but it was their understanding that the university's legal department felt that this was not in violation of that law. And I think that if there is a document that the university has written that expresses their view on the activity that they're engaged in today and want to have funded by by public money, and how that conforms with statute 145.422, I think that document ought to be circulated to members of this body. It's my understanding that no such document exists, that they haven't made any official pronouncement on their view of what they're doing and with respect to that law, and I think that would be important information for this body to have. But ultimately, I think that as much as we want the university to be a fine research institution, I think the question that we have to ask is, do we pursue research just for the sake of research, or do we also have to ask the question, what are we researching on? What is this research being conducted on? Is this a life that we're talking about here? And in the course of the research, are we destroying that life, or is it something else? And that is a question that bears on this bill. And I think that's a question that this body has to come to some understanding of. Are we talking about a life here, or are we talking about something else? Now, I believe that this is a life. And if it is not, then I would think that others should make the case why it is not. But to me, the law that we have says that research on or the use of a living human conceptus. And looking up in the dictionary, conceptus, to me, as I understand it, is a fertilized cell, which would certainly be an embryo. And that is not permitted if the result of that research is the destruction of that embryo. So, members, this is very troubling. I think that we ought to reject this. I think we ought to pursue at the university their formal rationale for why they think that what they're doing conforms with the law. I certainly don't think that we ought to extend their ability to do this by supplying public dollars to continue that research. And I would ask that we vote against this bill.
Senator Lemmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would Senator Lynch yield to a question?
She will yield.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Lynch, you made mention that the University of Minnesota a few minutes ago had some type of statement that said that they did not believe they were violating the law, specifically State Statute 145.422. Do you have any documentation or a statement from them that would state why they would believe that? The reason I'm bringing this question up is in Judiciary Committee, we had that very same question, and rightfully so, in the Judiciary Committee, whether or not this new policy would violate an earlier intent of the legislature as found in Minnesota Statute 145.422. And if you have some legal document, a legal opinion, could you present it to the body now? Because all we've heard from them was, we don't think we're violating any laws.
But, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair. I will yield to the author of the bill.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, let me respond very quickly. Senator Lemmer, I'm not sure that there's a written legal opinion. It's my understanding that what has been conveyed to the researchers is that the work they're doing is not in contravention of 145.421. And the reason I mentioned that earlier, that subdivision 3 living doesn't in any way comport with what this activity is.
Well, Mr. President, or Mr. Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
Senator Cohen, you made reference to a different state statute, 145.421. I'm bringing your attention to 422, which states very clearly, whoever uses or permits the use of a living human conceptus for any type of scientific laboratory research or other experimentation except to protect the life or health of the conceptus is guilty of a misdemeanor. Now, the way I read it, and I think the way anyone would read it, if the University of Minnesota or anyone else is experimenting using laboratory research, scientific research, they're violating that law. I don't know how anyone else can come to any other conclusion when you have the law specifically written the way it is. So I need to know, if we pass this, are we violating the spirit of the law and the letter of the law that we passed earlier when we placed Minnesota Statute 145.422 Subdivision 1 into law?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Chairman and Senator Lemmer, no. And I made reference to their statute because they're tied together. 145.421 provides the definitions that go along with 145.422. And Subdivision 3, living, as defined for the sole purpose of this section and Section 145.422, means the presence of evidence of life such as movement, heart, or respiratory activity. And it's the testimony from the university that this is not encompassed within that statute. So the answer to your question is pure and simply no.
Senator Lemmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we've been doing a little research on the word conceptus from an etymological standpoint in Latin, one conceived from past particle, a fertilized egg, embryo, or fetus. You know, many of us believe, and maybe you don't, but many of us believe that conception, whether it's artificially created or whether it's naturally created, is the very spark of human life. It starts there. We know that. Now, some may consider that not quite good enough to be called life. others do. That's always been embroiled in our legal discourse for about 40 years now. But nevertheless, the term conceptus, unless you have a definition in law that points to what it is, a fertilized egg is one where the conception has been created. Whether there's a heartbeat or not, there will be in a very short time. I think that the doctors all agree that within 21 days. Now, does that mean that an embryo can be harvested, put into this lab experiment, and then going further, does all of this experimentation take less than 21 days if you're going to split hairs on this?
I'm just
concerned that we have Minnesota state law to protect embryos and conceptus in our state books, and we already have a University of Minnesota that's even by the representatives at the University of Minnesota that are already admitting that they're doing it. So I'm very seriously concerned about where we're going with this bill. Now, stem cell research is a marvelous science that we should look into. But when we cross that line and go into the use of embryonic stem cell use, I have to say, warning, this is not the direction. This is not good public policy in order to endanger the very essence and beginning of life in an embryo.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lemmer, let me very quickly respond that being the case, if we accept your broader definition of these old statutes, then what also would be prohibited would be any fertilization clinic in the state of Minnesota, because you're describing exactly the same kind of process and procedure that is suggested by this statute. And that's why I provided the further refinement as contained within statute. So if it's a question of somebody being guilty of a misdemeanor, that's happened well before this type of research began.
Senator Lemmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Cohen, that was a good answer, except that Minnesota Statute 145.422 made an exception. They made an exception in that experimentation of a human embryo or a conceptus, and that's the exception to protect the life or the health of that conceptus. Fertilizing the egg is improving and creating a better health for the conceptus in and of itself. So there is already granted an exception to do exactly that. So the merit of your argument is wrong.
Further discussion, Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This will always be a debate on this floor, and there will always be divisions. But I think about it, and I truly, really can't understand why the university is so dead set on embryonic stem cell in the forms that they want to talk about. In our world today, there have been so many advances that it's absolutely incredible. Did you know that when a child is born, you can take that cord blood and you can have it frozen for future use for any disease in your family or other families? And that is stem cell. You can obtain stem cells and do stem cell research, and stem cell things can happen from that cord blood. Did you know that the placenta offers opportunities for stem cell research that are wonderful? Did you know that amniotic fluid offers opportunities for stem cells that are wonderful? And from these types of stem cells, there have already been medical advances that are working in people's lives. We know that. Did you know that as I stand here as an adult, I can donate many things that can lend to stem cell research? I can donate tissue out of my nose. Heaven knows my nose is big enough to give up a little, and you wouldn't even notice it's gone. They can do stem cell research from tissue from my nose. They can do stem cell research from bone marrow. Folks, it's going to hurt a little, but it's not going to kill me. That's the point. It's not going to kill me. You can do stem cell research from my bone marrow and not harm me. I can go have liposuction, and you can do stem cell research from the fat in a liposuction. And it's working. And it doesn't harm me. You don't kill me, and yet you get the research. Why do we have to destroy or kill a tiny living human being when it's not necessary? When we have adults standing right here. How many in this chamber? Probably about 80 people in this chamber that research can be done from without doing any harm whatsoever. Why not do something that does no harm? Did you know that there is a procedure using adult stem cells that can quell the shakes of Parkinson's by about 80%? No one was harmed in that research, and it can be done. Did you know that, and I don't remember if it was 60 Minutes or 2020 or one of those shows that I like to watch that talked about quadriplegics and paraplegics, that as a result of some adult stem cell, they're actually slowly recovering. It's not miraculous and they walk tomorrow, but it's working. Let's move forward without harming human beings. Let's move forward with the many, many ways that we can. Why not use what's working? Why not use what's available? Why not use what everyone would agree is ethical? Why not use what cures diseases and keeps human life intact? Why insist on destroying a human life to help another human life when you don't have to? We can move forward. It seems almost to me like there's a perverse desire to destroy human life, as though it's a better way to help somebody else if you destroy someone doing it. I don't think I help someone if I destroy one person to help another. I truly help someone if I save them both. And I do something that's good for both. And we can do something that's good for both. It's available. The organ tissue, the blood tissue, the placenta, all those things I talked about. There are so many things available. Let's use them. And let's not harm human life. Because we do not need to.
Senator Neville.
Mr. President, Mr. Chair, and members, I'd like to go back to the discussion between Senator Limmer and Cohen. This is an issue that I've been concerned about for at least 2 or 3 years. At least 2 years ago or more, I had a meeting with Dr. Frank Serra from the University of Minnesota, and he told me that they were doing embryonic stem cell research, and I pointed out the statutes to him that Senator Limmer referenced. And his response was, well, we have an opinion from our university attorney that we're not in violation of that statute. They were well aware of that statute. So I said, I'd like to see a copy of that legal opinion. I sent a formal letter to him, and I got a response back saying, we're not going to give it to you. If you want an opinion, ask the Minnesota Attorney General. So last year, I sent a letter to Mike Hatch, and I asked him the same question. I want an opinion on whether embryonic stem cell research violates these statutes. And I got a response, and it basically said, go and ask the lawyers from the University of Minnesota. So he wouldn't give me an opinion either. And in committee, there was a researcher from the U of M, and I said, do you have an opinion from the university that this doesn't violate the statutes that prohibits experimentation on human embryos? Oh, yes, we have one. And I asked Senator Cohen if he would try to get that opinion for me. I still don't have it. There's been a lot of misdirection, a lot of ambiguity, maybe cover-up. I just don't know. I want to see a legal theory that whatever they're doing doesn't violate the existing law that we have. And nobody is willing to offer it. Nobody's willing to put it down on paper and say, this is why embryonic stem cell research is not living. Senator Limmer, they're not disputing that it's a human conceptus. What I believe they're asserting is that it's not living. And I'm speculating now, that when the statute says living means the presence or of evidence of life, then it's followed by words such as. And they're saying that the such as is the big limitation. I would interpret that as meaning that it's such as, but the term presence or evidence of life is broader than that. Otherwise, there would be no point in defining conceptus from the moment of fertilization. That would render that part of the statute meaningless, and we have general statutory provisions that all of our statutes, when they work together, have to be internally consistent. So obviously, from the moment of fertilization, you're not going to have heartbeats and movement, but you do have life. But I have yet to see a legal opinion from a lawyer citing cases from somewhere or even articulating that with specificity. And until we determine that, we are on a very slippery slope in approving this bill. I can remember in 1973, when I was in law school, when the Roe versus Wade decision came down, and some of us, even back then when I was in law school, I said, well, what about the potential for the developing life? And they said, oh, don't worry about that. This decision only relates to the first 3 months. And some of us argued that there was going to be a slippery slope and that it would just be a matter of time and it would be 6 months and longer and there would be viable fetuses. And 34 years later, the slippery slope has come true. And this bill is the same. This bill is crossing the ethical and the moral line and putting us on a direction that's a very slippery slope. It allows cloning, and it allows experimentation on human conceptus, human beings. There hasn't been one single successful experiment on embryonic stem cells, not one, worldwide that I'm aware of. There have been dozens with respect to adult stem cells. Senator Lynch mentioned diabetes. Within the past month, there was the announcement that with adult stem cells, you can now treat diabetics to the point where they may not need insulin. That's hopeful. That's good. That's proper research. It doesn't violate any moral or ethical boundary line. We should pursue that with full vigor and give the university full sanction to do that. But what we're doing in this bill is we're giving them the authority and the sanction to cross the ethical and moral line. And I promise you, in 30 years, we will be creating fetuses to harvest organs. That's the slippery slope that we are beginning in this bill. And we shouldn't be doing it. And so I have an amendment that I would like to offer. It's the A3 amendment.
The Secretary will report the Neville A3 amendment.
Senator Neville moves to amend Senate File 100 as follows, page 1, line 7. This is the A-3 amendment. Is that correct, Senator?
Yes.
Senator Neville on the A-3 amendment.
Members, this is a very simple amendment. It just says that state-appropriated funds may not be expended on research involving derivation or use of human embryonic stem cells, human embryonic germ cells, or stem cells created from somatic cell nuclear transplantation, which is a cloning device. So what this amendment does is it says no cloning and no embryonic stem cell research. Other than that, full speed ahead. Go ahead. If this amendment were to pass, I suspect that there would be near unanimous support for the underlying bill for stem cell research. I know I would support stem cell research as long as it doesn't destroy a human being, a human embryo, a human life. And it also stops cloning, which I think also crosses the ethical and moral line. So I'd ask your strong consideration and support of this amendment, and I'd ask for a roll call vote.
Roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Three hands for a roll call. Seeing three hands, there will be a roll call. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, just briefly, would ask members to oppose the amendment. I appreciate what Senator Neville is attempting to do, but certainly what this amendment does is undercuts The University of Minnesota undercuts the opportunity to, again, make us a national leader as we once were. And I would ask members to vote no.
Senator Lemmer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to impose a call of the Senate for the duration of the bill.
We're in the committee of the whole, Senator Lemmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Cohen, could you explain to me page 1, line 16 for me? There's an interesting series of words, the words somatic cell nuclear transplantation. Could you tell me what that means? I think it has bearing on Senator Neville's amendment. Page 1, line 16.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lemmer, it's my understanding that that deals with a mixture, or the mixture of the usage of cells. Somatic obviously is derived from embryonic. It's I believe, not a synonym, but something similar to that. And this allows for an exchange of cells.
Well, Mr. President, or
Senator Lemmer,
Mr. Chair, to be accurate, according to the National Institute of Health's website glossary, somatic cell nuclear transplantation is just another word for cloning. They use the initials SCNT for somatic cell nuclear transplantation. It can be used for therapeutic or reproductive purposes. But the initial stage that combines an enucleated egg and a somatic cell nucleus is the same. So that process is what creates the embryo or the conceptus for one of two things, therapeutic or reproductive purposes. Your bill has, by that definition, usually using the National Institute of Health's website glossary, as exactly the definition to allow cloning to be done at the University of Minnesota. I hope our members are listening to this, because this brings us into a brave new world of scientific research. And I don't think ethically we're ready to go there. I don't believe ethically we're able to be prepared for what could come about. We haven't even reached the frontier of adult stem cell research, and now we want to create embryos for the purposes of therapeutic, meaning research cloning, or reproductive cloning. This is one of those issues that we have to approach with our eyes wide open. I believe we're not ready to go in that direction. I hope we're not ready to go in that direction. Dr. Mary Furpo, an embryonic stem cell researcher at the University of Minnesota, testified just a few days ago, February 22nd, in support of this process of somatic cell nuclear transplantation. This is their intent. This is what they've requested from the legislature. They want the green light to go forward on this type of cell adaptation, experimentation, and research. I use those words carefully, because that, again, goes back to the very different definition of what we were talking about before, about violating Minnesota state law: experimentation, research on any conceptus. Right now, that's against the law in the state of Minnesota, and yet this is going to ignore that law. They don't even have the concept of bringing forward an amendment to strike that law out of our books. They just want to keep going forward with the vague definition of, we don't really think we're violating any law. I agree with Senator Neville on his amendment. Minnesota shouldn't be a part of this type of brave new research. We have such hope and opportunity to expand adult stem cell research.
and all of the other great frontiers that will open up, we don't have to be harvesting and growing embryos for the purposes of stem cell research with our embryos.
Further discussion on the A3 amendment. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do support Senator Neville's amendment. And I've given I'm not a student in depth of this subject. Much of my reading has been in our local newspaper or in the publications I receive as an alum of the University of Minnesota. And the breakthroughs in research are in the adult stem cell and the other areas that Senator Wergen mentioned. Amazing things like even repairing nerve damage with the olfactory stem cells from our nose. And what that's led me to wonder and ask the question is, why the big thrust when we have access to stem cells in our own bodies that can do some marvelous things? What's the big push on the embryonic stem cell? Well, there are a couple of answers come to my mind from some basic reasoning. One is, if a doctor can take a stem cell from your own body and use it to treat you with, the only thing that there's a fee or a cost to that process is the action of doing it. There's no product involved. The notion of embryonic stem cells and the idea of you needing to replicate, clone, whatever it is that somehow out of this research might come a product that you can sell for money. And usually if you find in a lot of these issues, money is at the root of it all. So we want a product so that we can make money. Well then, the other advantage to a cell that can come from your own body for your own treatment is that your body won't reject it.
You want me to go up?
When you introduce foreign material, whether it's a transplanted organ or even from a transplanted, from a different genetic structure for that has been cloned or however else it's been produced, the body is going to reject it. So then you need to live the rest of your life on anti-rejection drugs, which would be, of course, all the reasons in the world for the pharmaceutical industry to like this, because this means money. And the other reality that Senator Neville brought out is that there is research going on. It just hasn't been funded with public money. So the whole thing is to get the public to invest in this research and take the risk for the potential to develop some item which can be patented or sold to make money so that the drug companies can make money on anti-rejection drugs. This doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And if there's evidence to the otherwise, I'll be happy to listen. But this is absolutely where the evidence is right now. And we do not need the embryonic stem cell research. We should be going full steam ahead with the adult stem cells and the other forms of stem cells from which research and new breakthroughs can come.
Yes, sir.
Discussion on the Neville 8th.
Mr. President.
Three amendment. Senator Cohn.
Mr. President, it's not been my intent to jump into this. I think we know how we're going to vote on this amendment. But with all the discussion about adult stem cell research, I do want to just add a quick comment. I made reference to the article in the Times relative to the U.S. Senate activity of about a month ago, or about 2 weeks ago. And in that article, there's a quote from John Gearhart. He is one of the preeminent stem cell researchers in the world. He's head of the program at Johns Hopkins. And what he said relative to the Senate amendment that would have done what is being discussed right now with utilizing adult stem cell research, nothing else, he said, We find this to be an absolutely bizarre bill because the presumption upon which it is based is flawed. That's the position of the people involved in the stem cell research. To limit this to adult stem cells is something that simply will not work. I always enjoy these debates on the floor of the Senate with none of us having the medical and research background that others have. I've quoted what the people who really are doing this think about it.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I rise to support Senator Neville's amendment. I believe that there are grave concerns about some of these procedures and things that we haven't even thought about. And one of the issues that we know is included in Senator Cohen's bill encompasses somatic cell nuclear transplantation, SCNT, which has been described as cloning. And in order to do cloning, there needs to be a large supply of an abundant supply of unfertilized eggs. And so that means that these have to be harvested from women, and leading to the potential for the exploitation of women, especially women who are in need of money. Currently, we have seen ads around some college campuses in states where this is highly encouraged, the embryonic stem cell research, to get women, and they like younger women because the eggs are usually better and easier to work with, to get them to come and take hormones that first shut down the ovaries and the release of eggs for a while, and then overstimulates. They take other hormones to overstimulate the ovaries so that they produce multiple eggs at once that can be harvested. And it's my understanding that they offer between $4,000 and $8,000 to these young women to come and have this process done. But this process is not without risks. Some of the medications that are given to women have been known to cause a number of side effects: chest pain, nausea, depression, emotional instability, muscular pain, bone pain, chronic enlargement of the thyroid, liver function abnormalities, vision abnormalities. So there are a number of side effects to this process, which we are doing to help other people, but may also be harming people in the process. It can also cause long-term infertility, something that, you know, we've used some of this process for to help people who are infertile, but some of the process itself could cause infertility by kind of, you know, affecting the ovaries of women, and we know that can have a long-term effect. And so, you know, there's a lot of concern about this, a lot of these issues that haven't been addressed. I know Senator Cohen said that we would like to be one of the leaders, but I don't think that jumping into this and using taxpayer dollars to try and get a jump start on something that it hasn't been successful, has other risks attached to it, is not a wise thing for Minnesota to do. And so I hope that you will join me in supporting Senator Neville's amendment.
On the amendment, Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. You know, as one of those people that I guess doesn't understand science, I find it really interesting to belong to a chamber or a legislature where we discuss the evils of genetically modified crops, where we probably will have little, if any, effect on human beings, and that is backed up by science. And yet we want to jump in to genetically modifying human beings or dealing with stem cells. It's interesting, members, I can recommend some reading on this subject. A nice short synopsis is called Of Clones and Clowns by Robert Weinberg. And he talks about exactly what somebody said earlier, members, about the money issue. And these are the clowns in the industry that would have you believe that this nuclear cell transfer, that cloning, can be done safely, effectively, and that we even understand a small portion of this, because we don't. We don't understand things. You can read Barry Commoner's The Unraveling of the DNA Myth, The Spurious Foundation of Genetic Engineering. That's an interesting one, too, members, in as much as it talks about over the years how our genetic engineering is so flawed and how we didn't realize, in fact, the Human Genome Project that was done quite some time ago, actually I think it finished around 2000, when we thought that we understood DNA, and we really didn't, because we thought there was one DNA action for each inherent trait in the human being. And what the Human Genome Project found out is that there's actually only 30,000 DNA items in the human body, which is the same as most plants or a mouse, in that actually we're put together with alternate splicing. Now, alternate splicing, members, is the way the DNA hooks with amino acids and things like that. But the bottom line is we have no control over the way these cells hook up through alternate splicing, and that's why we've proved with Dolly the sheep and other cloning is never going to work in what we know with modern science today. And until we understand and can really unravel what goes on with DNA, we're never going to get there. In fact, Weinberg says we may never get there, and we certainly do not have the scientific capability today to monitor what goes on as these cells reproduce under cloning. You know, members, someday you'll be able to convince me, and Weinberg goes there with this, that therapeutic cloning may be of value, but that we might be centuries away from reproductive cloning and even understanding how things hook up. And just so you understand, in terms of alternate splicing, members, a fruit fly, if anybody knows how tiny a fruit fly is, a fruit fly is the only thing we have actually counted the numbers and the times alternate splicing works in the DNA of a fruit fly in order to make up a fruit fly, and it's over 36,000 forms of alternate splicing, mixing of the DNA with amino acids to create a fruit fly, over 36,000 times that alternate splicing happens. We have no clue how it happens with a human being in the embryonic process. This is scary stuff to be financing with tax dollars.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, members, what we're talking about is spending taxpayer dollars on experimenting or for experiments that destroy human embryos, that destroy human life. And we're talking about spending tax dollars on something that we find morally objectionable and not promising. Several other senators have mentioned today about the over 75 known treatments and advances that have been made with adult stem cell research. Everybody wants cures. Everybody in the state, everybody in this body, everybody in the country wants to be able to make those advances and find cures and find treatments for people. Adult stem cells research is showing that. We are finding advances and treatments through adult stem cell, not through embryonic stem cell research. And we find that morally objectionable with using state taxpayer dollars to destroy human embryos. I support the Neville Amendment. I think it moves our focus to the research with adult stem cell research that is making advances. I want to see 66 or 67, however many senators are here, vote on that final bill. As Senator Neville mentioned, if we can put this amendment on and move that focus to adult stem cell research, I think that is where we're really going to find the cures and the hope that people are looking for in promises as we advance the University of Minnesota with adult stem cell research. And I think what we need to do is put this amendment on so that we can all agree that we're looking for those cures and we can comfortably use, without the moral objection, state taxpayer dollars to do that.
Secretary will take the roll on the Neville Amendment. Control. senators, having voted, desire to vote. Secretary will close the roll. There be 25 ayes and 37 nays. The amendment is not adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 100. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, disappointed that we were not able to adopt Senator Neville's amendment. And I think we're now looking at the final vote. And I don't know, Mr. Chairman, if there has been a roll call asked for on this final, on the passage. I'd like to see a roll call on the final vote.
Three hands for roll call. There will be a roll call.
Thank you,
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I'm concerned that what we're doing here is evidence that we've lost our moral compass to some degree, that we're acting out of a sense of expediency. We really aren't debating, or we shouldn't be debating, what we can do. I'm not a scientist. I know there's many things that science can, many things that scientists can do, many things that science is capable of working on, but what we're really debating is what we ought to do. And I think the question that we have to ask is whether this is putting us into a position of going in a direction that is dangerous. And we've heard the argument. People have talked about the slippery slope. There's another word for that. It's incrementalism. You take steps that seem to be reasonable at this point, and after some time goes by, further steps seem reasonable in the light of what we've already done, and so forth and so on. And we've certainly seen that, as Senator Neville pointed out, in the course of the debate on the life issues and their various manifestations, and this is a critical step in that path. And I would urge us not to take that step. I think there have been times in human history where we have seen societies go down this path, and I'm a student of history, as Senator Cohen and others are, and one of the things that has always troubled me as I've read the history of what went on in Europe and Germany prior to World War II, and I'm not trying to make any kind of analogy of that. I'm not trying to make some gross analogy here, but it's always been a wonderment to me that you had a society, a highly educated society, one of the best educated society in Europe or even in the world at the time, very cultured, and that they were able over some period of time to allow things that were unimaginable. How that ever happened, I don't know, and I don't know if anybody understands that, but somehow they did. Somehow they got to a point of allowing or tolerating certain things to be done that if they would have been asked sometime earlier if they would ever contemplated doing those things, they would have said no. And I think that that's what we have to ask ourselves, is what does this lead us to? That there is a logic to these things. Once you give up the principle, you've got to acknowledge that there is an inexorable logic to what we do. The principle we ought to be standing with is, do we believe that human life is always an end and never a means to an end? That is the principle. Once we give up on that, then where you draw the line and say, well, this is expedient, this is possible, that line is always going to depend on whatever the political whims are, the political winds of the day, whatever the majorities of the time might believe to be expedient. And we ought not to be subjecting these kinds of questions to that kind of decision-making. We ought to say, what is the principle that we are willing to defend? If we believe that human life is always an end in itself, never the means to something else, then we ought to reject this bill. I don't want to say Minnesota is a leader in the technology of embryonic stem cell research. I don't want to say that. I don't believe that that is anything to be proud of. I think that we can be proud of our state as being a leader in research. We can be proud of our state and a leader of stem cell research of various kinds. I don't think we ought to say, let's be a leader in the research that involves the destruction of life, the life that is most vulnerable, the life that cannot speak for itself. And so, members, I would urge a no vote. And again, I'd ask for a roll call.
The question occurs on the motion by Senator Cohn. That senator, before that, Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would Senator Cohn yield?
Senator Cohn will yield. Senator Senjum.
Senator Cohn, there are obviously perplexing aspects of this bill, but one of those that I have, and it's certainly already been referred to, and I think we just have to clarify it because, well, I believe it's the case, I'm not altogether sure, and I'm looking for confirmation, Senator Cohn. We've talked a lot about cloning, and so would this bill, as written, allow cloning, allow the possibility of genetically identical offspring to be created in a laboratory? Because if that's the case, that's very troubling, at least to me, and I think a lot of Minnesotans. But I want to confirm that with you before I assume that.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman and Senator St. John, I do not believe that there's anything in this bill that would allow cloning, but I actually do have an amendment that would make that clear. And I can offer very quickly, I know we have conference committees, I can offer the A51 amendment, which states very simply, research permitted under this section must not include cloning. And that would take care of your concern. I don't think it's necessary, but if it's comfort language for people here, I'd be happy to offer and move the A51 amendment.
Senator, the Secretary will report the A51 Cohen amendment.
Senator Cohen moves to amend Senate File 100 as follows, page 1, line 14. This is the A51 amendment.
Senator Cobley, or
Mr. Cohen. Chairman, I'd move the amendment. It's a simple amendment and should clarify Senator Senjum's question.
On the amendment, Senator Robley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If Senator Cohen would yield, I'd like to ask if when he says that he eliminates cloning, does that also eliminate the somatic cell nuclear transplantation, which is defined by the National Institute of Health as cloning?
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, my intent was to offer a very simple amendment to prohibit cloning, period.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Cohen, you may be making a very simple amendment, but as you know by the discussion today, it's a very complex issue. And if I can refer you back to page 1, line 16 of your bill, it makes reference exactly to the very words that Senator Roebling just mentioned, the somatic cell nuclear transplantation. So I'm trying to understand the simplicity of your amendment as it relates to line 16, page 1. Now, I'm just using this little-known National Institute of Health website glossary definition, and it's talking about, and we would be authorizing by your language, the use for therapeutic or reproductive purposes, the initial stage it combines an enucleated egg and a somatic cell nucleus, and it's the same purpose in order to create the cell, whether it's for cloning or otherwise. So I think Senator Roebling's question is right on point. Just because you have this simple amendment, you're using the word cloning, but the word somatic cell nuclear transplantation can be defined. It is defined by a very well-known national health resource, and it could be used for exactly for cloning. So I'm not sure if the simplicity of your amendment is getting to the concern that many members have.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, very quickly, my response to Senator Senjum was that there was nothing in this bill that would allow cloning in the context in which we understand it. It was in that spirit I offered the amendment, but Senator Limmer, if this is something that you think is too complicated, I'll withdraw the amendment. Let's vote on the bill.
The amendment has been withdrawn. The question occurs on the motion by Senator Cohen that Senate File 100 be recommended to pass. This is on the bill. Secretary will take before the roll call, Senator Vandiver.
Mr. President, I did want to make a couple comments about this bill. I think we've heard today, and most of us know that have looked at this closely, and believe me, I have, that the positive results from the fetal stem cell research are speculative at best, that the advances are exclusively in the adult stem cell area, and that members, even if this were successful, cannibalizing our young in order to provide benefits to us today is never the answer. Abandoning morals and ethics for personal gain, temporary personal gain, isn't good for society. It's not a good example for our children.
the ones we do allow to live, and it's not good policy as a society. So I think we should vote against this and leave things develop the way they will. But at this point, there simply is no scientific reason to do this, and there certainly is no moral or ethical foundation for us to proceed with this. Thank you.
Secretary, Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to, if I could, move the Cohen Amendment.
Okay, Senator Senjum, Secretary will report your amendment.
Senator Senjum moves to amend Senate File 100 as follows. Page 1, line 14, this is the A51 amendment.
Discussion on the amendment. Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair, I think we've had discussion. Okay. Just do the vote. A roll call, please.
Secretary will report. Take the roll on the Senjum A50. Senator Neville on the amendment.
I was going to mention this before until Senator Cohen withdrew it, but one of the witnesses, I can't remember if this is the same one Senator Cohen used in our hearing, Dr. Mary Furpo from the U of M, testified before the other body that one way of cloning a human being is by using SCNT. As long as SCNT remains in the bill, we've got cloning in the bill. And this amendment, it creates nothing but ambiguity, because saying that we don't have cloning but still SCNT is permitted is still permitting cloning. So I would respectfully urge a no vote on this amendment.
Secretary will take the roll on the Senjum motion to amend. All senators having voted, desire to vote. Secretary will close the roll, being 62 ayes, 1 nay. The amendment is adopted. Senator Cole, the question, 62-0. The question occurs on the motion by Senator Cohen that Senate File 100 be recommended to pass. Secretary will take the roll on the bill. All senators having voted, desire to vote. Secretary will close the roll. There'll be 36 ayes, 26 nays. The bill is recommended to pass. Senator Pogermiller.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee do now arise and report.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. The Senate will come to order. Senator Pogermiller.
Mr. President, I move that the report of the Committee of the Whole, as kept by the Secretary, be now adopted.
On the motion, all those in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails.
And, Mr. President, I understand Senator Ortman has a motion, and Senator Cohen has a conference committee report.
Did you say Senator Wergen?
Ortman.
Oh, Senator Ortman.
Senator Ortman moves that Senate File 1045 be taken from the table.
On the motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would move that the Senate do not concur in the amendments by the House to Senate File Number 1045 and that a conference committee of three members be appointed by the Subcommittee on Conference Committees on the part of the Senate to act with a like conference committee appointed on the part of the House.
On the motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
There's a
Privilege report at the desk.
Next item of business is the conference committee report on Senate File 846.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. President, I move that the foregoing recommendations and conference committee report on Senate File 846 be now adopted and the bill be repassed as amended by the conference committee.
Should explain.
Mr. President, on the motion, this is the deficiency bill. The difference between the House and the Senate was negligible. All the appropriations were the same. There was a slight difference in language relative to the Met Council appropriation for the purchase of buses. And so we came up with some language, actually with Senator Clark's language, to reach agreement between the House and the Senate. But basically it was pretty almost exactly what the Senate language was. I'm not sure if Senator Clark has anything to add to that.
On the motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Discussion? Secretary will give the Senate File 846 its third reading.
Senate File 846, a bill for an act relating to state government, providing deficiency funding for certain state agencies, appropriating money, etc.
Secretary will take the roll.
What else we have?
All senators having voted, desire to vote. Secretary will close the roll. There being 62 ayes, 0 nays. The bill is passed. It's title agreed to. Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. President, are there any other work at the desk?
Did you want to appoint the conferees on the Senator Ortman's committee?
I would move a brief recess for the purposes of appointing a conference committee.
Brief recess has been moved. All in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Senate will come to order.
Mr. President, is there a privilege report at the desk?
There's a privilege report at the desk. Pretty soon there will be. Report the
Senator Pogemiller from the Subcommittee on Conference Committees recommends the following senators be and hereby appointed as a conference committee on Senate File 1045. Senators Ortman, Roebling, and Johnson D. Senator Pogemiller moves the foregoing appointments be approved.
On the Pogemiller motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. I believe that completes the work at the desk, Mr. Majority Leader. Announcement, Senator Higgins.
Mr. President, the Public Safety Conference Committee will meet at 2:30, and the Policy Working Group will meet at 7.
Senator Betzold.
President, the State Government Budget Division Conference Committee will be meeting at 2 o'clock in the basement conference room of the State Office Building.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. President and members, the Health and Human Services Omnibus Conference Committee will be meeting as soon as we can get there. Please try to get there as soon as you can, members.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. President, the Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Finance Conference Committee will meet at 3 o'clock in room 107.
Senator Pappas.
The Higher Education Conference Committee will meet in a half an hour. That's 2:20 in room 318 of the Capitol. Please be prompt.
Senator Langseth.
Mr. President, members, the Capital Investment Conference Committee will meet at 2:30 and 1:25. Hopefully the bill will be ready for us.
Senator Vickerman.
Mr. President, members, Agriculture and Veterans Budget Conference Committee will meet immediately.
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, the Transportation Conference Committee will meet at 3 o'clock, and the Transportation Committee, the Senate Transportation Committee, will meet at 6 p.m. this evening.
Senator Clark.
The E-12 Conference Committee will meet in 1:12 immediately.
Any other announcements? Without objection, Senator Gimsey, Stump, and Senator Scoy be excused from today's session all day. Senator Bach from 11 to 11:20, and Senator Scheid from 11 to 11:20. Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. President, the Majority Caucus, those who are available, will meet at 5:20 in room 15. We have a special guest, room 5:20, room 15. And we have a governor, we have a visiting governor. Not our governor, a different governor. So, although I want to make it clear, Mr. President, that our governor is welcome to come to our caucus.
He could visit
so
with
chooses.
Us.
I would then move that this. I would yield to Senator Day.
Senator Day.
Well, I was just wondering, does I take it that this governor doesn't like Republicans that's visiting you?
All right, I think so. I think everybody, invite
everybody.
I think
you're welcome to come also. She is visiting with Governor Plenty today, so you're certainly welcome also.
I'll be there, Senator Day. Now,
5:20, room 15.
Show up now. You asked for it. Arizona. Senator Pogemiller.
It's the governor of Arizona. Governor of Arizona. Mr. President, I move that the Senate adjourn till Thursday, April 26th, 10 a.m.
On the motion to adjourn to Thursday at 10 a.m., all those in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Senate stands adjourned.